Thanks, Bianca and Renate for the invitation to give these two days of lectures. So, I want to tell you about tensor networks as a method to compute partition functions. Surprise, we will focus on the two-dimensional Ising model. And now we'll start with a 45-minute introduction to the Ising model. So, as Bianca said, you should have a copy of this. So I'm not going to be using the blackboard because there are many drawings, and I'm not capable of drawing them in real time. And probably that also works for you. So please make sure you have a copy, okay, and take notes if you need to take notes, but starting from that copy. Now, today and tomorrow, together with Clément. Clément, are you here?
Yeah.
Hi, Clément. So we'll be having these two lectures in the morning and one tutorial in the afternoon on this introduction to tensor networks. That's today and tomorrow. And then this will connect well, hopefully, with the lectures on coarse-graining of spin foams on Wednesday and Thursday. So you can take this as a building up towards that part. And then the other comment is I had a very strange visit to my orthodontist on Thursday, and I'm trying to learn to speak again. So, I apologize if at some point you cannot understand me. Insist, I'll try to repeat things. And finally, the danger of using slides is that you go faster than you should. So please slow me down if there is any need. OK, so let's get started. So let's start with an overview of what we will see in the four lectures and the two tutorials. I'm going to talk about partition functions. We'll take the two-dimensional Ising model as an example. At this point, I don't need to introduce this anymore. We'll have spin configurations. A spin configuration would be deciding all these spins, each one whether it's up or down, plus or minus one. And then we'll have a Hamiltonian that will be deciding, given a configuration, what's the energy attached to this configuration. For instance, for the Ising model, we'll have this one here, the ferromagnetic Ising model, as you've seen. And then there will be a Boltzmann weight attached to this configuration, and the partition function is just this sum of all these Boltzmann weights. Okay? So this is the object we're interested in. And this object consists of a number of sums, which is exponential in the number of spins. Okay? So if you want to consider a large lattice, you have to make many sums. You have to spend lots of computational resources. Actually, you can see that the computational cost grows exponentially in the number of spins. And so at that point, one could say, OK, I'm not going to make this sum explicitly, but maybe I'll use Monte Carlo sampling to try to identify, to approximate this partition function. And what we want to do here instead is we want to break the problem into two steps. One will be what we will see today, which is that we can express this partition function as the product of small tensors, as a tensor network of this form. Okay, so we'll have one tensor per spin. These tensors will be connected. So every circle here is a tensor. Each tensor is connected to a neighboring tensor through an index or a black leg. This leg here represents an index. And the fact that it's shared between the two tensors means that there is a sum, or this index is contracted. Okay, so we will see today that this partition function can be exactly represented as a tensor network. We haven't done much. We have just re-expressed the object that we wanted to compute. Okay? And tomorrow we'll see that we can actually coarse-grain this tensor network in a way that we go from n times n spin or tensors to n over 2 times n over 2 tensors. And we can iterate this coarse-grain transformation until all this mess has been converted into a single tensor. Where, for simplicity, I didn't draw this, but this leg is contracted with this one, so there are periodic boundary conditions in the x direction, in the y direction. So this lattice lives on a torus. And therefore, the result of the coarse, of this coarse graining will be that this single tensor is also, this index is contacted with this one and this one, and so we'll have just a number. Okay? So the idea is that we don't know in general how to compute, how to extract the partition function or the number z coming from this tensor network, which is just a representation of this sum. But we will learn how to coarse grain this in such a way that we will end up having to make a very small manipulation of a single tensor, and then we will be able to compute an approximation to the partition function. Okay, this coarse grain transformation will not be exact. There will be some error introduced at each step. And so eventually, we'll obtain the partition an approximation to the partition function. Very good. So, and then there are two aspects to this that we will see tomorrow. First is that we'll be able to do this computation efficiently. So instead of the cost being exponential in the number of spins, it's going to be logarithmic in the number of spins, which is double exponential gain. So that's going to be very, very fast. Okay. But we will also analyze whether this allows us to define a renormalization group flow in which we could identify a fixed point and learn about the physics, not just by computing partition functions and two-point correlators from them and so on, but actually by studying this flow towards some fixed point. So that's also what we will see tomorrow. Okay, so today. Today, we have two lectures. And our aim, as I said, is to understand how to compute partition functions with the example of the two-dimensionalizing model. But the first lecture will be about a related problem, which is how to describe the ground state of the quantumizing model in one dimension. Okay? So there is a well-known relation between a classical partition function in the dimensions and a quantum system in D plus one space-time dimensions. Okay? So the two-dimensionalizing model, classicalizing model, is related to the one-dimensional quantumizing model. Okay? And what we are going to see is that it's worth understanding the structure of entanglement in ground states. We'll see this through introducing some singular value decomposition of matrices and tensors. Then we'll see the main result here, which is that there is an area law for the entanglement of ground states. I will investigate a toy model wave function that describes this area law. And then in the second lecture, we'll just be translating this to the context of the partition function. Okay? So if you just care about partition functions, this will look like a very strange detour. But I want to encourage you to think of this as something that, first, is closely related to the partition function. And second, it's something useful to learn on its own. Okay, so every time, even if you are interested in classical partition functions in two dimensions, actually, the tricks that we'll be playing, the key why we can efficiently compute this partition function has to do with how we can also efficiently compute ground states in one dimension. Okay, so that's what this first lecture is about. Very good. So, 1D quantum. Let's start with the quantum spin chain. Now, we still have quantum spins. So we have spins. Each spin can be up or down, as in the classical case. But remember, this is a quantum spin. So we describe it with a vector space. In this case, C2. Two complex numbers will be enough to describe a more general wave function, psi. I'm going to be using psi1 and psi2 to represent these two complex numbers. And instead of talking about spin up or down, I'm going to talk about the state 1 and 2, okay? Just notation. So the idea is that any quantum state of a spin 1/2 degree of freedom can be represented in some basis, 1 and 2, by giving two complex numbers, psi 1 and psi 2. Very good. So if we had n quantum spins, then as you know, the Hilbert space is going to be n copies, or the tensor product of n times this Hilbert space for one spin. And the more general wave function we can still expand it in a tensor product of states for each of the spins. And then this time what we have is that instead of having to specify two complex numbers, we need to specify 2^n complex numbers. Okay? and then if a complex number represented, if a vector of two complex numbers are represented with a circle with a lec, where the lec is the index that takes two values, this tensor here will have n indices. Okay? So all these 2^n complex coefficients can be represented by a tensor with n lecs. Okay? And that's the point where you can ask questions if this notation is not clear, but I'll be using this all the time. When you see a circle with a number of lecs, that's a tensor where each lec is an index of the tensor. Okay? It's a way of representing this multi-dimensional arrays of complex numbers. Very good. So this is a quantum world. So we have a quantum Hamiltonian for the Ising model, the transverse field Ising model. That would be as simple as Pauli matrices, sigma z between nearest neighbors. That's just a ferromagnetic coupling with a minus sign. So it's telling, again, the spins to align in the same direction as in the classical case. But now what we have is a transverse magnetic field in another direction, in the x direction. And these two terms compete. And the ground state of this Hamiltonian, defined as the state with smallest possible energy, so it's an eigenstate of this operator with smallest energy. Well, what we would like to do is to compute this ground state. And then the big problem we have here is that we have a computational cost that, again, as in the classical case, is exponential in the number of spins. Okay, so if we want to do things exactly, we'll have this exponential cost. And how do you want to think about this exponential cost? Well, just try to write the wave function, right? You'll have to specify exponentially many 2^n, right? Exponentially many complex coefficients. So try to put it in your computer, and you'll see that as you increase the system size, the memory that you need to put these complex coefficients grows exponentially. That's, as you know, a big problem. All right, so this is our wave function. This is the tensor network. Well, this is a tensor representing all these exponentially many coefficients. And in one sentence, a tensor network is going to be a way of breaking these exponentially many coefficients to a way of representing these exponentially many coefficients as the product of a small tensors. Okay? So we'll break this big tensor, we'll express it as the product of a small tensors. Now, why do we want to do this? As I said, this requires exponentially many parameters, 2^n parameters. The number of parameters is exponential in the number of spins. Whereas here, what we're going to do is that we're only going to have to add one tensor per spin. So the number of tensors is proportional to the number of spins, and so is the number of parameters that we need. Okay? We'll need to specify only order n complex coefficients to have a representation of the ground state. Now, even though the title of this lecture is Introduction to Tensor Networks or Tensor Network Methods, tensor networks are mostly about wave functions, and this is not what I'm going to be telling you. Okay? So if you want to learn more, you know, there are fancy names, the acronyms are really bad, MPS, Meta, PEPS, there are many tensor networks proposed for different systems that work in different ways. And if you want to learn more about this, there are plenty of resources, and you could start by going to PI's talk repository, and you know, you can watch a lecture on precisely these type of things. But that's not what I'm going to do today. But what we need to learn about these tensor networks is how is it possible that we can represent ground states in such an economical way. That's what we'll need to learn, because we need to import that to partition functions. Okay? So what we need to understand is, first, why is it possible that ground states of local Hamiltonians can be represented economically, efficiently, just with a number of parameters that grows proportional to the system size, as opposed to exponential in the system size. Okay, and it turns out that in order to understand this, we need to talk about ground state entanglement. Okay, so I'll be talking about ground state entanglement. And in particular, I want to tell you about this area law. The area law would be the way in which the entanglement in ground states is organized. Okay, and that is the reason why we can have these very simple descriptions of ground states. Any question? Good. So let's start. Yeah.
So just to slow you down a little bit, I'm sorry if I do that. So one of these diagrams is just one tensor with n indices.
That's right.
And then this decomposition from the big blob to the smaller blobs, this is not a unique decomposition, right?
Let's see. Maybe what worries you is that we have 2 to the n parameters here, exponentially many, and here we only have order n parameters. So how can you match the two things, right? That would be a natural question. Is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So it turns out that this decomposition, this is a way of decomposing this wave function as a tensor network. This is not possible in general, okay? No free lunch type of thing. So only for very special types of wave functions, that's possible. Okay, so your question is really the question. Why can we do this? And so this is the question here, right? So we need to understand how is it possible that we can go from exponentially many parameters to order n. And I insist that in general, this is not possible. So a generic wave function of n spins, if you choose 2 to the n complex coefficient randomly, okay, on this side, you won't be able to match them to such a simple decomposition.
For the ground state, this is always possible.
Exactly. So the magic is that in the last 10, 15 years, we started to understand that ground states are very special. They are special in many senses. But in one way in which they are special is that systematically, for all types of Hamiltonians that are local, okay, we find that we can decompose them in a simple way. And what they have in common, actually, the reason why we can do that is because they obey the so-called area law in entanglement entropy. Okay? And so what I want to do next is to build up and explaining this area law. So this is essential, right? This is the essential ingredient that will allow us for an efficient representation and an efficient computation. Question?
You mean only gap system, or you mean beyond that?
Okay, so that's also a relevant question, because depending on whether our, so I'm going to insist that the Hamiltonian has to be local, right? If it's a spin chain, I want nearest neighbor, or maybe nearest neighbor next to nearest neighbor, or maybe even, you know, some power law decay of interactions. But there is a sense of locality, okay? So two distant spins don't interact like crazy. There is some organization. In one dimension, it could be in two dimensions, in three dimensions. We will have to use different tensor networks to deal with different dimensions. But an important question is whether the Hamiltonian is gap or gapless, whether there is a finite energy separation between ground state and first excited state or not. Okay? And depending on that, for instance, in one dimension, we would be using, if it's a gap system, we would be using a tensor network like this. If it's a gapless system, we may want to use a tensor network like that. Okay? And there are many details that I will not be explaining. But indeed, we need to adjust a little bit to the physics. Okay?
So the quality sign there, that is an equality sign? Or was it some kind of approximation?
Very good. So, so if you give me a tensor network like this, and I contract all the tensors, all the shared indices, I end up with a wave function on n of n spins. So this thing here represents a wave function of n spins. Now, not all wave functions of n spins can be represented in this way, only some of them. Okay. So in general, this may not be an equality. It may be an approximation. And it can be a very bad approximation. So only for ground states of local Hamiltonians, we will see, or I will keep saying, that this can be a very good approximation.
Even more elementary question, but maybe
related. The wave functions that you consider, are they anti-symmetrized with respect to indices? In other words, are you considering particles that are identical fermions?
We could play this game, but it's not going to be relevant here. So just think about the spin 1/2. So this behave statistically as bosons, not as fermions. And this will be good enough. There is a fermionic version of this. We can also talk about anions. You know, all these things can be generalized. But I'll stick to the Ising model, spins, because it's the simplest setting. And the main ideas, this area law, and its consequences, all this is valid more generally, but is already present here. So we'll look at the simplest scenario. OK? Good. OK, so let's keep doing this. You stop me. So I want to tell you then about entanglement. We want to understand what's this magic that happens for ground states. And I need to start with the case where we only have two quantum systems, say two spins, or more generally two n-level systems. And what we can do in this case is to always represent the wave function as a linear combination of, well, we choose a product basis, a basis for part A, part B, right? We have system A and system B with vector spaces VA and VB. And so we can always expand this wave function. Okay, it's, you know, you choose a basis and you expand your wave function. Now, I'm going to need to define an entangled state. And first, I need to define what's a product state. So I'm going to say that this wave function of A and B is a product state if it can be written as a state for the first part, for say the first spin, and a state times a state for the second spin. Okay? And here's an example. Suppose that the first spin is state 1 and the second spin is state 1. That's a product state. Okay? And I'm going to switch. I'm not going to write the tensor product all the time. So this 1a, 1b means precisely this state. Okay. So it could be spin up. Right. Very good. So then we say that a state of these two systems is entangled. Well, if it cannot be written as a product state. Okay. If there is no way of writing it as a state of the first system or first spin times the state of the second spin. And so here's an example where we have a linear combination of 1, 1 plus 2, 2. Okay? So the two spins are in a superposition of the first spin and second spin being in state up, say, and the second spin and first spin and second spin being in state down. Okay? And I mean, this is basic, but if you've seen it, and it's not basic if you haven't seen it, so I'm not sure with whom I'm talking. But hopefully you've seen quantum mechanics, and this is fine. Oh, quantum gravity. Wait, yeah, probably. So, since you know so much, is this guy entangled or is this guy not entangled? Okay? Let's have a look at this. Let's look at the definitions. Does this look like a product state or does it look like we need more terms than just one? And I learned this from Gerard. You. Can you? Do you know if this is a product state or not? Ah, yes. Ah, yes. Sorry, what was the specification? Last row. Okay. Oh, yeah. So would you say this is a product state? Can we bring it into a form where it's just a state for the first spin and state for the times state for the second spin? Oh, is it too small?
No, it's fine.
I can ask someone from the first row. OK.
It's
a what?
You can have a majority vote, yes.
Majority vote. OK, who thinks it's a product state? Who has not been to this lecture before and thinks it's a product state? Okay, why is this a product state?
It's Jonah? 1 plus 2 in A times 1 plus 2 in B.
Very good. So it's sometimes not obvious. You have to look carefully, okay? But we want to ask the question, can I represent my wave function as a product of a wave function for the first spin and a wave function for the second spin, A and B? And that's what's happening here, okay? So how about this one? Looks the same. 1, 1 plus 1, 2 plus 2, 1 minus 2, 2. Okay? Sorry?
It's entangled.
Why?
Because you cannot write it as a sum in the first A and the sum.
How do you know?
Because then, in order to write it in the above form, then I would have to have a minus 1 to B.
Very good. So it's tricky. It's not obvious, but you know it can be decided. Okay. And actually, the fastest way to decide whether a state is entangled or not is by remembering something about linear algebra. Okay. So let me remind you: if we have a matrix, there is something called the singular value decomposition. So what's the singular value decomposition? Well, this matrix can always be written as the product of a unitary U. Unitary matrix U times a diagonal matrix S with diagonal elements which are non-negative, so positive reals, positive or zero, which are called the singular values of the matrix M, times another unitary V diagonal. Okay? So any matrix can be written in this way, can be decomposed as a singular value in its singular value decomposition. And we're going to be using this. But let me rewrite this in our diagrammatic notation. So the first matrix, the matrix is going to be, you see, this is a matrix because it's a circle with two legs, so two indices. Okay. And then this is going to be equal to, this time I've rearranged this as the product of u times the square root of s and square root of s times v. Okay? So that's just some decomposition that we can always do by remembering linear algebra. And in the wave function, in the end, when I wrote this fancy linear combination, actually this thing here is a tensor with two indices, I and j. So this is just a matrix. Okay? When we talk about the bipartite entangled state, we're talking about a matrix. And so we could just do the singular value decomposition. We could reorganize all these guys in here. And in the end, what we will end up with is with some expression in terms of a singular values that I just write as square root of p alpha. Okay, so this coefficients here are just the singular values, and this thing is known as the Schmidt decomposition, but it's just the quantum mechanical guy's way of calling the singular value decomposition. Okay, good. So when we have this decomposition, why is the singular value decomposition useful? Well, you can have a look at the singular values. Okay. The singular values, and here's an example of singular values in red. I plot 10 singular values, and they are all the same. Okay, and if you look at the single a matrix which has this type of singular values, you better stay away from it. Don't try to break it, to simplify it, or anything. This guy cannot be simplified. Okay, but if the singular values look like this. So you have a very large singular value. The first one is, say, order 1. The second one is much smaller. And by the time you get to the 10th one, it's, I don't know, 10 to the minus 8. Okay? This is good news. If you wanted to simplify this matrix, what you could do is, in an approximate way, of course, you could remove some of the singular values, and which give you contributions that are, say, 6 orders of magnitude smaller than the leading ones. And nobody would notice. Okay, this would affect whatever calculation you're doing on the sixth digit. Okay, so we'll be looking at Schmidt decompositions of wave functions, or the same as singular value decompositions of matrices. We'll look at the singular values or Schmidt coefficients, and whenever we see that there is this type of profile where some of the singular values are very small, we'll say, hey, time to get rid of those. It's an approximation, but it's a very good approximation. Yes?
So I don't really see the connection between your
they're above decomposition and one below. So both you have two square roots of s, and now you have one square root
of p. Yeah, that's because I'm really bad with annotation. Okay. So I was trying to use the notation that we use for in linear algebra, and then the one that they use when talking about entanglement, and the match is not terribly good. But what I wanted to say is that there is something called Schmidt decomposition, okay, that brings your wave function as a single sum instead of having to add over two indices, I and j. You have a single sum, and this single sum is actually over the singular values of the original metric. Okay.
Okay, so you're not absorbing any singular values into the two components, or just having the ones square root of p or d, the singular.
These are the singular values. Yes. Now that I see it here, I'm thinking, huh, bad choice. Yes. But the idea is the one that I want to take from here, right? That there is a systematic way of writing your bipartite wave function in terms of the singular values, and that these are the parameters that you want to look at and see, because these are the ones that will allow you to remove part of the wave function and part of the complexity of describing the wave function without actually changing much the wave function.
Okay? So phi is u times I and p times j?
This one here?
Those two.
These two, yes.
Okay.
So. Right, so I had a complicated expression relating them to. So, okay, so basically these are the columns of U and the rows of V. Okay, so all the information is there. I didn't want to go into those details because we will not be using them. And now I realize that maybe it's a bit of a jump. But all the information about who these guys are here is contained in this original matrix psi ij.
And the psi ij.
Sorry?
So that's psi is a matrix. So you do singular value decomposition for psi, and then.
Yeah. So the identification is this, is a matrix. And these guys are the singular values that we'll have up here. OK? Good. So I need to ask you a couple of with examples. So for instance, if they give you this wave function, I want you to tell me what are these coefficients, these Schmidt coefficients here, the p alpha. Okay. So for this case, for instance, you want to see that you have already a single sum. There is only one element, and what you want to see is that there is only one. That these coefficients, one is a one, and the rest are zeros. Okay. That would be the first example. So when you have a product state. A product state is such that when you apply the Schmidt decomposition, you get only one singular value, one Schmidt value, okay? That is one, and the rest are zero. If you had instead a disentangled state, 1, 1 plus 2, 2, okay, with 1 over square root of 2, then we would like to know what the coefficients are here, okay? And so you can see. Does anybody want to tell me what the coefficients are in this case?
It's a half and a half.
Right. So the coefficients are going to be a half and a half, and then zeros that we don't write. Okay. The way to do that is just remember you square this guy, okay, and it appears in front of every single, in front of the 1, 1, and in front of the 2, 2. So 1/2 and 1/2. Okay. So take the singular values and square them, and you get this vector. This is a probability, right? P alpha adds to, if you add all these guys, the sum is 1, and so on. So you have a probability distribution, and you want to pay attention to this one, and you want to know whether it's a flat probability distribution, like the red dots here, or whether it's a sharp probability distribution picked and then fastly decaying. And that's what we are going to be paying attention to. All right? Good. So let's talk about this once more. Let's talk about the truncation. So here we have the Schmidt decomposition. Imagine we have 10 non-zero Schmidt values or singular values. And if we had the representation, So if the Schmidt coefficients or Schmidt values, if all of those were similar, okay, if you decide to chop away, say, four of them, then you're chopping away 4/10 of the wave function. You're losing accuracy on the spot. Okay? You cannot do that. You are not allowed to do that. You can always do it, but it will give rise to very poor approximation. But imagine instead that the singular values decay very fast. Okay? So for instance, in this case, if we just keep the 6 first, what we're throwing away, the last 4, are on the order of 10 to the minus 6 or less. Okay? So in this example, we could simplify this decomposition. We could, if these were the singular values, we could go from 10 terms in this decomposition to 6, and yet obtain a very good approximation to the wave function in the sense that the expectation value, the expectation values would be from the original wave function, and the approximation would be similar up to corrections of order 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so that's what we represent here. And diagrammatically, what we'll say is that we can simplify this bond. We can make it thinner. Okay, yes?
So first of all, how do you determine how many of these values to keep? And then second, as an addition, do any of these errors from the approximation propagate in a way that they're magnified?
Okay, so quantum mechanics is linear. So let me answer the second question first. Everything propagates linearly.
Okay.
So it's fine. Right? So you introduce an error of 10 to the minus 6 at this point, and it stays 10 to the minus 6 if this is the only error you introduce. Yes? How do you determine this? Well, a possibility would be to compute this decomposition, have a look at the singular values, and you decide how much you want to truncate away. Right? You know exactly what the error you're making, what error you're making, and so that's up to you. Yeah. Okay. Good. So it's a bit. So in general, it's worth, instead of talking about all these singular values, maybe we can just compute the entropy attached to it, to them, and so that's what we do, and that's what we call entanglement entropy. Okay. Instead of keeping a list of the singular values, just to analyze the situation, to diagnose how well we might be able to truncate, we could just instead compute the entanglement entropy. And for instance, for a product state, the entanglement entropy is just minus the sum of p alpha log p alpha. And so for a product state, we just discussed that this vector of single values, it's a 1, 0, 0, 0. So if you compute the entropy of that, you get 0. Okay. So for a product state, we have no entanglement. That's what we wanted. Okay. This is a good measure of entanglement. If for a product state, it was not an entangled state, so it's good that the entropy measuring entanglement is 0. Now let's have a look at what happens if we have this linear combination of 1, 1 plus 2, 2. In this case, the vector of this probability was 1 half, 1 half. When you compute the entropy attached to this probability, you get a 1. Okay? So we confirm that this other state is entangled. And in general, we could have a more complicated wave function. Say, in this case, let's take a linear combination, not of 1, 1 and 2, 2, but 1, 1, 2, 2, all the way to dd. And then you can easily convince yourself that the entanglement is grows logarithmically in the number of levels d. Okay, so I have a question. If I look at these two profiles, which one will have more entropy? The red one or the blue one? The red one. Very good. Why?
All the coefficients are the same.
Okay, so if you have, so this blue one looks more like the product state. You have one main contribution and the rest are, well, in the product state zero, here are small. Whereas the red one looks like this state, which we actually call maximally entangled state for a reason. It's the one that has more entanglement.
Okay.
Okay, so when you see a distribution like this, you say, okay, that's a lot of entropy. When you see a distribution like that, you say, okay, that's not as much entropy. Okay, good. So now we've been dealing with matrices in the last few minutes. I want to quickly generalize this to tensors. So if instead of a matrix we have a tensor, what we're going to do is a tensor has many indices, in this case 5. And what we can do is we can look at this tensor as a matrix by joining, say, these two indices, ij, and by joining the three indices k, l, and m together. Now we have a matrix. We can apply a singular value decomposition, okay? And then we can split the indices again, and we would obtain something like that. So what I'm saying is that whenever you have a tensor, even though the singular value decomposition is for matrices, you can convert that tensor into a matrix by joining indices into two groups and apply the singular value decomposition to that matrix and then unjoining, separating the indices again. Okay? And of course, the singular value decomposition of a tensor is not well defined until you tell me how you want to join the indices into two groups. Okay? So there might be many different singular value decompositions, but once you tell me how I map this tensor into a matrix by telling me how I group the indices into two groups, then we have a singular value decomposition. So the same for wave functions. So given a wave function of, say, 5 systems, A, B, C, D, and E, which we can represent by this tensor with 5 indices, okay, we can apply a single Smith decomposition by just joining these 5 indices into two sets, in this case, maybe A and B together and C and D, C, D, E together. Now we have a matrix, we can apply a single value decomposition, okay? So the Smith decomposition, the name that people in entanglement gives to the single value decomposition, the Smith decomposition, in this case, again, we can perform it according to this bipartition, AB versus CDE. And again, we can have a look at the Smith coefficients and decide whether this can be truncated or not. OK? Question?
So a matrix will, in general, depend on how I group the indices together, right? The approximation.
That right.
So how do I decide how to group them together?
It will be decided for you. So the area law will tell us that there is a way of breaking your wave function that has to do with locality. So in a one-dimensional system, we'll break the left. You know, we can break n spins by cutting somewhere. So we join the left together, the left spins, the right spins together. Okay, this bipartition will have very low entropy. And now you can cut anywhere you want. It's going to be a left-right cut. You are not, so this will give you very low entropy and the possibility of truncating away most of the wave function. If instead you have this n spins on the real line, and now you say, okay, you put together 1, 3, 5, 7, and the 2, 4, 6, that's not going to work. It's going to give you flat spectrum, and there is nothing you can truncate. And this is precisely the property we want to learn about wave functions for ground states, that if you cut them in the right way, they'll have very low entropy, and you will be able to truncate this Smith decomposition. OK, so I'm running out of time. Look, I was going to tell you the story that you can break the wave function in different ways, OK? And for each of these, we call it entanglement cut. We can compute the singular values and see whether there is something that can be done. In particular, we could compute the entropy. We can plot it. Okay, we can plot the entropy as a function of which cut we're looking at. For instance, in this case, we have 1 cut, 2, 3, 4. For each cut, we compute the entropy. We have some drawing. And now we can investigate how this drawing grows. Okay. Bianca. 5 more minutes to finish this before the break?
Yeah.
Okay. So now that's what we want to do. We want to take our spin chain in the ground state, okay? And we want to partition the wave function. Actually, maybe it's not in the ground state. Let's first consider a very special type of state where each partition gives you the possible maximal entanglement, and then you'll have that And when you cut here, you'll get some amount of entropy, of entanglement. When you cut there, the second cut, you'll get more, and so on. And the maximally entangled state for all possible cuts would give you something like this. Okay, you can build such wave functions, and you'll have a lot of entanglement. Now, here's the surprise. If you go and pick up at random a wave function, right, meaning you choose 2 to the n, you have n spins, so if you pick up at random n complex, 2 to the n complex coefficients, and this is your wave function, when you look at the entanglement, okay, this profile of entanglement with respect to different cuts, you get that it's maximal entropy everywhere, or almost maximal entropy everywhere. So a generic wave function, if you try to simplify it by looking at the Schmidt decomposition and throwing away pieces of it, there is nothing small to be thrown away. Okay? Okay, so that would be a generic complex, a generic wave function, but we don't care about generic wave functions today, we care about ground states. So let's have a look at what happens when we plot the same for a ground state of a local Hamiltonian. And here's the answer. Okay? That for all the cuts that you can think of, the entropy is very slow, very small. Okay? The entropy is very small means that you can truncate away a lot of Schmidt coefficients. And that's going to be the key. That's the key to these efficient calculations. So I'm going to have to stop here. This is known as the area law. It basically says, let me just announce it. So what we're going to say is that imagine now an infinite chain. The chain is infinite, so the size of the system doesn't matter anymore. And now we look at the region, a finite region of size L, okay? And we ask how much entanglement is there if we spin decompose between this region and the rest of the system, okay? And what we find is that for a generic wave function, this should grow linearly. The entanglement entropy would grow linearly in the size of the region. Whereas for a ground state, it just doesn't want to grow linearly. It stays very, very low. Okay? And how low? Well, actually, it becomes a constant. So it doesn't grow with the system size. Okay? So maybe at the beginning, when your region is very small, this still grows a little bit, but it saturates to a constant as you increase the region. And so that's known as the area law. And that's maybe the most important result. Everything will follow from here. That we have that the entropy attached to, when we are working with the ground state, the entropy attached to a region, instead of growing with the size of the region, it grows with the size of the boundary of the region. Okay? And the boundary of a region in 1D is just two disconnected pieces. It's constant. The size of the boundary is constant. Okay? So the entropy is constant. Okay? But actually, this happens in more general dimensions. And so if we were working in two special dimensions, you have your infinite two-dimensional lattice, you look at the square region, okay, and you ask, how much entropy do I have there when I'm in the ground state? And the answer is going to be, it's going to be proportional to the size of the boundary of the region. Okay? Ground states obey this area law in two dimensions, three dimensions, and so on. Always the amount of entropy in the ground state. The amount of entropy on a finite region is not proportional to the size of the region, but to the size of the boundary of the region. Okay? And I'm going to have to stop here, and we'll continue later on. All right.